Now I get to tap it again. Members, today is March 4th. The time is 1 p.m. I call this meeting and Committee on Health Finance Policy to order. There's a quorum present. May I have a motion to approve the minutes for February 25th, 2026?
So moved, Mr. Chair.
Representative Bierman moves approval of the minutes for February 25, 2026. Any discussion? Hearing none, those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries, and the minutes for February 25th, 2026 are approved. Today, we have a 20-minute presentation. Then we will do 10 minutes of questions. Then we'll take our first bill and move to a vote after 30 minutes. Then we'll do our last bill of the day and again take a vote after 30 minutes. Didn't we just approve them? Oh, I need to have a motion to approve the minutes.
I'll make that motion, sir.
Thank you. Representative Rapinski moves the approval of the minutes. Any discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Motion prevails. Minutes of March 2nd, 2026 are approved.
March 3rd.
All right. We're beginning with a presentation from the National Conference of State Legislators on House Resolution 1 conformity. I invite Catherine Costanza, a fellow at the National Conference of State Legislators, to be at the table, begin her presentation. Please limit your presentation to 20 minutes.
Thank you. Am I on? Can you hear me?
Okay. To ensure I'm accommodating the time, I'm going to set a timer for myself. Okay. Thank you very much for inviting me to speak. As Vice Chair Nato said, I am Catherine Costanza. I'm a fellow with the health program from the National Conference of State Legislatures, and I'll be here to talk about Medicaid eligibility changes in 2026 related to the One Big Beautiful Bill Act and or H.R. 1 or OB3, however we may refer to it throughout. I see a lot of familiar faces in the room, but if you're not already familiar, the National Conference of State Legislatures, or NCSL, is all of your professional, bipartisan, and nonpartisan membership organization. We provide all of the services listed on this slide, including technical assistance presentations like this one, and confidential and individualized research requests. So if you do have any questions that we are unable to get to during the presentation today, please don't hesitate to reach out to me directly or any of my colleagues at NCSL, and we will get you all the information you need. So today we'll do a brief overview of OB3 and the state legislative role, an overview of the Medicaid eligibility changes in OB3, and then briefly touch on some of the federal recoupment authorities in OB3 that are related to eligibility in the bill. We'll go ahead and dig right in. So what does OB3 do? At a high level, it reduces federal Medicaid spending over the next 10 years by addressing federal cost drivers. And these are in three primary areas related to eligibility, specifically Medicaid expansion eligibility for non-disabled adults between the ages of 19 and 64. Additionally, it addresses state-directed payments, which are additional payments made to providers, and state financing arrangements, specifically those related to provider taxes. For purposes of our hearing today, we are only really going to be discussing the eligibility changes, but we do have additional information on the rest of these changes upon request. We will also be talking about the erroneous excess payments provision, as that is specifically related to eligibility implementation that will be occurring this year. And when we think of the state legislative role when it comes to Medicaid and specifically the eligibility changes, state activity could fall into multiple categories related to your appropriations authority to balance the state budget, manage budget risk and uncertainty, oversee costs, and invest in systems modernization. Your oversight role will also be important here as it relates to overseeing the implementation of significant eligibility changes, as well as the accuracy and program integrity of those, and the value and cost effectiveness of how your Medicaid agency is operating. Coordination across governmental and community stakeholders, as multiple entities will be involved in implementing these eligibility changes, as well as in facilitating coverage to or transitions to other coverage sources, economic mobility. and aligning state laws with new federal requirements and adapting existing state laws to for fast-moving implementations in this space. So digging right in. So OB3 makes significant changes to eligibility, specifically for the expansion population. But before we dig into those, there were several other changes to eligibility made that will apply across all states, including changes to retroactive eligibility, requirements to check the death master file that's maintained by the Social Security Administration, and requiring states to collect information on address verification. So starting with retroactive eligibility, all states, previously states were permitted to provide retroactive eligibility up to 90 days. Before an individual received a confirmed application. That is now changed to 1 month prior to application for expansion enrollees and 2 months for non-expansion enrollees, and that's effective January 1st, 2027. In all states, states will newly be required to check the death master file at least quarterly to confirm if any Medicaid beneficiaries are deceased. That's also effective January 1st, 2027. And states are now newly required to collect enrollee addresses using reliable data sources and also using information collected from managed care organizations, also effective January 1st, 2027. And an additional comment I'll make on this particular one is this is on the address verification. CMS will also be obligated to create an address verification system to prevent duplicate enrollment of a single beneficiary in two states, but that won't roll out until later. So this is just the first of the states obligations to collect that data. Additionally, all states will be making changes to non-citizen eligibility in 2026. Effective October 1st, 2026, some immigrants with lawful immigration status will no longer be eligible for Medicaid, including asylees, refugees, and victims of human trafficking and domestic violence. And then we pivot into the changes that are specific to Medicaid expansion states. So these include a new requirement to redetermine eligibility every 6 months instead of every 12 months, and that's effective January 1st, 2027, and new requirements to implement cost sharing, although that won't go into effect until October 2028, so that's not happening this year. Additionally, the a primary change to Medicaid eligibility and the most significant one for states to implement are Medicaid work and community engagement requirements. So now, as a condition of eligibility for Medicaid expansion enrollees, they will now have to demonstrate that they meet worker community engagement requirements or meet one of the exceptions available. I'm not going to linger on this slide in detail, but I will point out that there are three kind of types of policy buckets here. One is the qualifying activities that an individual must meet to demonstrate that they are participating in worker community engagement. One is the mandatory exemptions that states are required to implement as exemptions from needing to perform qualifying activities. And the third are short-term optional hardship exemptions that states have a choice of whether or not to implement. Oh, and these also go into effect January 1st, 2027. When looking at some state flexibilities in implementing worker community engagement, states have choices as to whether or not to require 1 month of qualifying activities, 2 months, or 3 months of qualifying activities in that look-back period. So whether an individual qualifies for worker community engagement, they must perform either 1, 2, or 3 months of those qualifying activities, which could, for example, be 80 hours of qualifying work, enrollment in an education program, et cetera. States can also choose whether to require consecutive or non-consecutive months of qualifying activities. So, for example, if they require 2 months of qualifying activities within a six-month period, they can choose whether or not those have to be consecutive back-to-back or whether they can be non-consecutive for any 2 months in that six-month period. They can also choose whether to use any of the optional short-term hardship exemptions, and they can choose to implement before January 1st, 2027, such as Nebraska has indicated that it is going early. If you want more details about how this all works, we also have linked a webinar here for related to these Medicaid eligibility changes that provides some hypothetical examples of what that could look like. It's also hard to overstate the importance of building new existing data connections for all this eligibility implementation. So both for the changes that will apply in all states as well as for work and community engagement requirement implementation, states will need to build or strengthen existing data connections between their Medicaid agency, state workforce agencies, corrections data, the master death file, SNAP and TANF program data, and many other data sources in order to accurately verify qualifying work activities as well as mandatory exemptions from those activities. And another thing to point out is that OB3 also requires states to conduct to determine eligibility using any reliable information sources they have available to the state before reaching out to beneficiaries. So these data connections are both a component of the accuracy of it as well as an obligation of the state. Additionally, I'm not going to linger on the program integrity side of this. We'll get to that later. States will have access to $200 million in grants. That's for all 50 states. To support state implementation activities, and states are also eligible for a 90% federal match for the design, development, installation, and enhancement of these eligibility systems. Broadly, the implementation timeline is very fast. So you saw the effective date is January 1st, 2027 for a lot of those provisions. It's coming up quite quickly, and it's important to note that your Medicaid agency is literally building the track as the train is running. We won't get CMS guidance until June of this year, and so the state agency is making choices and will need to make choices before they have final guidance and may need to revise estimates around what that implementation timeline looks like and what the costs will look like based on guidance from CMS once it's received. There are anticipated to be coverage losses associated with this and potential downstream effects related to churn out of and into the program, potential impacts on uncompensated care and changes to per enrollee costs, although it's a little too early to tell exactly how that will flesh out. And it is anticipated that it will be challenging to make accurate determinations for special populations, particularly those subject to the exemptions, so caregivers, individuals with behavioral health or other disabling conditions, those individuals who are incarcerated, and rural populations as well. So when we think of what states have done or can consider doing to implement work and community engagement, we see several examples here, including modernizing systems and processes. And this can include streamlining the forms that beneficiaries use, as well as investing in system modernization. So both Colorado and Missouri enacted legislation in prior years, streamlining the application form for beneficiaries. Iowa enacted legislation last year, creating an information technology fund for public benefit system modernization. And Virginia has introduced similar legislation this session. States can also consider public reporting requirements. One thing that states learned during the unwinding, where they had to redetermine eligibility frequently, was that timely information about how the process was working was helpful for upgrading and ensuring that the system was making eligibility determinations accurately. California enacted legislation in 2024 that goes into effect January of this year, requiring public reporting on certain Medicaid call center data collected from counties. Nebraska has introduced legislation that would require fairly comprehensive public reporting related to work and community engagement requirements, including the number of automatic determinations made for qualifying enrollment, mandatory exemptions, and re-enrollment in the program. And North Carolina enacted legislation requiring a report back to the legislature, which they have already conducted and is also linked. States can also consider options to facilitate transitions to other coverage sources. So for the individuals who will no longer be eligible under work and community engagement, states have several existing Medicaid eligibility pathways that are intended to facilitate economic mobility and transition to other coverage sources, including premium assistance programs and transitional medical assistance programs, where states can help pay cost sharing for employer-sponsored insurance on behalf of an individual who is enrolled in Medicaid or may no longer be eligible for Medicaid. So 38 states have these premium assistance programs, and Connecticut leveraged both transitional medical assistance and subsidized marketplace plans during the unwinding process. States can also focus on employment support programs. So states like Montana and New Hampshire both provide state-funded employment support programs for Medicaid expansion enrollees, which can include things like child care or transportation supports, as well as job training and other other supports related to that program. An evaluation of Montana's program between 2016 and 2019 did find that that program increased earnings of Medicaid expansion enrollees and facilitated continued employment after the end of that support was provided. And states like Nevada and Washington have also analyzed who employs their Medicaid beneficiaries to better understand who might have access to employer-sponsored insurance. Interestingly, Washington has also pending legislation in the state that would leverage an employer assessment equal to 100% of the managed care capitation cost for employers, certain employers of Medicaid beneficiaries that would go into effect when work and community engagement requirements go into effect. That legislation is pending, though. We'll see where it goes. Additionally, states can consider policies to facilitate interagency coordination and automated eligibility and renewals. So, again, connecting those data systems to ensure accurate eligibility implementation. Indiana enacted legislation in 2025 requiring Medicaid, its state agency, to check multiple federal and state data sources, including wage corrections, other employment data, and more. States like Illinois have previously required the inclusion of older adults and people with disabilities in those automatic renewals. And states like North Carolina and Maine have previously required reporting or connections between their corrections agency and Medicaid. And that's an example here because individuals who are incarcerated are one of the populations who are subject to mandatory exemptions under work and community engagement. So even though that wasn't directly related to this particular implementation, it is analogous and aligned work. States can also focus on beneficiary communication and outreach, either through benefits navigators or through community assisters. Montana established enacted legislation requiring an online portal for community assisters to help them submit required documents and monitor application progress. And previously, during the unwinding, Illinois and Minnesota appropriated funding for navigators. Your beneficiary advisory councils will also be important here. This is a mandatory obligation of state Medicaid agencies, but again, that connection with beneficiaries can provide real-time feedback on how implementation is rolling out. And states can also consider whether advanced technology and artificial intelligence may help facilitate the implementation of work and community engagement requirements. I won't linger on these examples, but I will point out that Maryland was awarded a grant specifically to develop AI tools to streamline work verification across Medicaid and SNAP and to lead efforts to roll out similar initiatives in multiple states. And so now I'll get into federal recruitment authorities. So an important provision of OB3 is the erroneous access to transportation. And what this does is it increases the likelihood of federal recoupment in 2029 and beyond for any payments that exceed the state's allowable error rate. I'm not going to get into the weeds on this because we
don't. State Representative Kristen.
I don't want to turn it off. I'm so sorry.
I won't linger on this particular provision, but the takeaway is that the accuracy of state implementation of eligibility changes in this year will impact state Medicaid payment error rates and could trigger recoupments in 2029 and beyond. Additionally, the federal government has multiple authorities to recoup funds for any program integrity or other non-compliant activities that they see occurring even before then. So we wouldn't necessarily have to wait for 2029 to see federal action in this space. Broadly, when it comes to federal recruitment authorities and processes, it's important to note that this is not a single streamlined pathway. There is not a, like, you enter into, like, noncompliance as a state and there is a clear, cycle of the steps. There's multiple options and enforcement authorities that are both available to the federal government and available to the state as states go through and identify program integrity concerns, as well as negotiate the resolution of those concerns with the federal government. It starts with kind of identification and correction. Program review occurs at both the federal and the state level, as well as through federal and state audits. States are responsible for implementing quality control in their Medicaid eligibility programs, and states have options to create corrective action and to take corrective action. Then there are federal enforcement authorities, such as deferrals, disallowances, the reduction of the federal match, and withholding of federal financial participation. Each one of these has different due process considerations associated with them. So for example, deferrals and disallowances traditionally come up with respect to specific claims that the federal government will claim are non-compliant. If CMS decides to disallow some of those claims, they have to provide notice of that and then reconsideration. Broadly, CMS cannot withhold federal financial participation absent notice and a hearing on that particular withholding. So these are specific authorities that have specific appeals associated with them. And I can answer more questions about that if needed. And finally, I'll just point out that we have additional resources on all of these topics. And anything that we talked about here today, I promise you we have more that we could possibly share. And you can reach out to me anytime. And with that, I believe I'm at time. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you so much for your presentation. And now we're going to move to, for the next 10 minutes, we're going to move to member questions. We're going to start with Representative Elkins and then Representative Bierman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted that this presentation wasn't posted on the website, committee website, and I would really, really like to get a copy of it.
I'm informed that it's posted now. Thank you. Representative Bierman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Constanza, good to see you again. Thank you for being here. Really appreciate it. I'm going to just guess this is what you're going around states talking about mostly these days. This is the largest cut to health care in this country I have ever seen. And I was just wondering if you have any knowledge of anything else that compares in history that would have cut off this much health care from so many people at one time through one bill.
Go ahead. I'm not representing it, though, if you just go ahead with that, please. Thank you.
Thank you. And thank you, Chair, and thank you, Representative Bierman. I can't speak to that question. This is certainly, I think, the largest federal legislative activity we have seen since the Affordable Care Act. This does make significant reductions in federal spending on the Medicaid program. And as it does so, that will shift costs to states.
Chair, Barry, go ahead.
Thank you. I'm just wondering about, you know, I'm hearing a lot of numbers about the amount that has been cut, particularly here in Minnesota, but nationally, what do you have a kind of a running total as you look deeper into this and see all its aspects in the further years? What sort of cost are we looking at, a cumulative impact to healthcare in this country with this bill?
Thank you.
Yes, Chair. Go ahead, please.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Rep. Bierman. There are estimates that several organizations have done regarding how each state will be impacted and the amount of federal revenue that they are anticipated to lose. I believe from KFF, some of the initial analysis that they did was that states could anticipate losing anywhere between 4 and 19% of federal revenue related to the Medicaid program. It varies by state, and I'd be more than happy to share out some of those estimates of the anticipated impact to states. I also believe RAND just came out with an analysis within the last 2 days. I haven't had a chance to review it, but I from what I understand, it conducts a more current analysis than what was being conducted at the time that this bill was becoming enacted last year.
One more. Yep, go ahead.
Thank you.
Chair Bierman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to go to the work requirements. You gave us some information on that as well. And imposing work requirements has been done in different states over the last years. And I just wondered if you could speak a little to the history of the states that have done that, comment on what their studies that have been done about those states, what have they learned as far as the efficacy of those studies or of those actions to impose these work requirements, if you would, please. Thank you.
Go ahead, Ms. How can you pronounce your last name?
Costanza, like George on Seinfeld.
Oh, okay. Well, thank you for that word picture. Go ahead, Ms. Costanza. I just didn't put that in. Thank you.
Thank you to the chairs. Yes, so prior to now, when all states will be required to implement work and community engagement, both Arkansas and Georgia have had experience actually implementing work and community engagement requirements, and there have been a couple evaluations of the outcomes of those activities. Arkansas and implemented work and community engagement requirements under the first Trump administration in about 2018. An evaluation, there's one evaluation in particular of that was published in Health Affairs that found that approximately 17,000 individuals lost coverage, even though some were eligible for Medicaid because they had qualifying work activities or met other exemptions. They also found it did not improve work employment outcomes. And Georgia's model was implemented, I'm trying to remember exactly the year, but it was implemented during the Biden administration as a result of holdover litigation. When implemented, there were the Georgia, I believe, Center for Budget and Policy Priorities. I might be getting the name wrong, but I can pass out, I can share some of the exact evaluations. Found that there were upfront administrative costs for implementing work and community engagement requirements, and that fewer individuals enrolled in the state's program than had been anticipated because of the way the state rolled out work and community engagement. A couple caveats to this. These are two states, and two states is not a lot of data to work with. Additionally, state policy choices in how the state chooses to roll out work and community engagement requirements are likely to have a significant impact on the outcomes associated with work and community engagement, which is part of the reason I think some states are looking at public reporting requirements to better understand how these will roll out in their state and to see if that aligns with the state's priorities. So there are some caveats to that data. Additionally, in the Georgia context, I'll point out that there are anticipated to be upfront implementation costs that will alleviate over time. There will be ongoing staffing costs, but some of the information system updates that will occur will be upfront one-time costs, not necessarily ongoing costs. So the Georgia information on the administrative costs of implementation may hold true upfront, but may not hold true over the long term.
Mr. Chair, one tiny little follow-up.
Yeah, and that will be the last question.
So the question I had was, is there a rough percentage of people that were determined that they were eligible who are already on the program? Like, I've heard 70, 80% of people who are required to do work requirements or have an express exemption to be on work requirements, that it's a very large number, and the number of people who were not eligible at any given time, because this is changing based on what they're doing. It could be childcare, physical disabilities, et cetera. So just wanted to see if there was any percentage that they discovered in those two states.
Go ahead, Costanza. Thank you. Go ahead.
Thank you to the chairs. That is an excellent question. KFF has done some analysis of who may either qualify, meet qualifying activities, and/or an exemption I don't recall the figures off the top of my head, but I would be happy to pull them for you. If I recall correctly, I think approximately 60% of enrollees meet qualifying work activities, and depending on the state, 20 to 30% of other enrollees may meet qualifying exemptions, but it depends on the state. KFF also has a state-specific breakdown of this data in states where they have verifiable data, so I would be more than happy to share that with you on exactly what that looks like in Minnesota if KFF has that data. They don't have it for all states, but I'd be happy to share that out.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, so we have a tight schedule. I know I have members for questions. We are going to go to the bill, House File 3439. That's where we're going to go. We will be taking a vote on that bill at 2:10. Doesn't matter how many people will be on the list. Just giving everybody's heads up. Also, we want to, Representative Doe, you wanted to reconsider with some minutes there. Well, I wasn't here.
Yes, Mr. Chair and members, I made a mistake. I would like to reconsider the motion that we approve the minutes on March 2nd, 2026. The minutes indicate it was March 3rd, and so I just want to clarify that. I'd like a motion to reconsider the minutes first, and
okay,
then we move to actually approve the minutes for March 2nd of 2026, and I'm sorry, members.
Okay. So the motion on the floor is to reconsider the motion to approve the minutes. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed? Motion carries. Now, Representative Doe, you want to approve the March 2nd?
I move to approve the minutes from March 2nd, 2026.
Okay. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed? Motion carries. And so, thank you so much. First of all, I think you're on. No, you're not. Okay. Thank you so much for sharing your information. Please stay around. And then we are going to the first bill to be considered today is House File 3439. Representative Nadeau, would you like to move House File 3439 to get it in, before the committee?
You would
like to move your bill to get in front of the committee, correct, Vice Chair Nadeau?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Okay.
I move my bill.
Okay, good. Representative Nadeau moves that House File 3439 be recommended to be referred to the Committee of Human Service, Finance, and Policy. We have the bill before us. Representative Nadeau, please share with us about the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I'm going to try to go very quickly, but I want to, at the beginning, I want to reiterate that I believe that this has to be a committee bill. I'm willing to take oral amendments today. I'm willing to take all offers of how to do this. There's significant lack of guidance. And before I go on, I also want to mention that Annie is not here today, for those of you that don't remember this. And it's so sad that she's not here because we worked so hard on putting this bill together. So if you ask me super technical questions, I'm going to move them over to Elizabeth and Melissa, but I'll do my very, very best. We approached this, and I'm going to address both bills right now, and then we'll move into 3439. But the potential impacts to nonconformance, I think Ms. Costanza had just, you know, really spent quite a good time doing that. In Minnesota, we just saw with the latest economic forecast that we're looking at a $400 million hit in 2027. And in the 28-29, it's $1.6 billion, and we've heard estimates all the way up to $3.5 billion that we might experience due to nonconformance. And if we fail to conform, CMS, as Ms. Costanza noted, can withhold federal matching funds, delay approval of state plan amendments, freeze enhanced funding tied to administrative components. And I just want to remind the body that CMS has a massively broad authority to to basically call a state plan out of compliance. They can also require the state to submit formal correction action plans do additional reporting that we don't get compensated for, and then provide documented documented demonstration progress as well. The potential clawbacks are also significant. If non-compliance results in improper eligibility, we can have program-specific penalties and work requirements, eligibility verification, administrative reforms, and also, as Ms. Costanza noted, FMAP reductions tied to administrative functions and freezing funds for optional benefits. That's setting the stage. I don't think any of us are happy about being here today. I think this is going to be a tough. I think this is going to be a tough row for us to hoe, but I think that my intent is to try to put us in a direction where CMS looks at Minnesota and says, you know, here's the intent and the space and that Minnesota wants to try to fill. When we started looking at this, we looked at the things that were specifically that was more of this committee's oversight, and focused on those issues with effective dates that are happening prior to our return to this building. We looked at six-month redetermination expansion for enrollees. CMS was supposed to issue guidance on this by the end of last year, but they still haven't done it. So we tried to address a little bit of that. Non-citizens eligibility conforming with the with HR 1 limiting non-citizen eligibility. For MA to lawful permanent residents, and then the community engagement component would be the second bill. I'm going to go through the bill. It's not that long, but I do want to go through. I want to go through it because we need to. The first section, I'm going to start right at the beginning. This is basically the expedited disability determinations. And remember, this is primarily for our expansion population, the adults with adult children. That begins basically starting on line 1.23, 1.24. Moving into section 3 on 3.19, we're now dealing with the period of eligibility. This is we're currently at a three-month look back. We're looking at a one-month. The bill is written that it would be a one-month look back for the expansion population, two-month look back for the remaining populations. Line 3.28, we're complying with HR 1 six-month redeterminations, not faster. Line 4.1 is the exception for our native populations. And then down in 4.17 to 4.23, once again, this is eligibility determinations for MA Minnesota Care and the basic health plan that we have in Minnesota. Starting on line 5.28, this is a new section. This is, Ms. Costanza talked about this a little bit. This is the review of the death master file. This is a whole new section in law. And I don't know how much space we have here to comply. I know that we have to do it, but I don't know if I, one of the questions that I have that I wasn't able to ask Annie is on 6.10. Should this, you know, should there be a specific timeline for this when we discontinue payment? Should it be 30 days, 10 days? Should it be 6 months? So that is the review of the death master file requirements, and then we move into starting on 6.21, our citizenship requirements, and this is, you know, one of those. This is limiting MA eligibility to migrant workers, citizenship. If you go down into 6.3 to 6.32, we're talking, there are some specific things set out in HR 1. It's a compact for free association, that COFA population, but we're limiting MA eligibility to lawful permanent residents, and then with the, and along with Cuban, Haitian, and the COFA migrants. Bouncing ahead to eligibility, starting on line 11.2, eligibility retroactive effect restrictions. This is the one-month expansion. This is 1 month for the expansion population, 2 months for the other population, mimicking what we've done previously. And then in section 9, starting at 11.17, this is for our managed care contracts. This is our PMAP population. I do have a question for I'm certain this includes our county-based purchasing. In line 11.19, maybe Representative Liebling can look at that and make sure that I have that right, that it does include county-based purchasing as well. And members, that's the bill.
Thank you, Representative Dole. So now we have three testifiers that signed up. There's also written testimony in your packet and online. So we're going, all testifiers will be limited to 2 minutes. You will get a 30-second notice. You got 30 final seconds left. That will be done by us up here. So first one is Scott Centoria, and yes, he's on Zoom. Okay, hold on. Can you hear? Say.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair.
We can hear you now. Let's turn that baby. You'll have to speak up a little louder. We have you maxed out.
Excellent. You might be able to tell from my Italian last name that speaking loudly is not a problem on my end. So thank you, sir. I appreciate it, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm Scott Centorino. I am a visiting fellow at FGA Action. Before coming back to FGA Action last month, I was the special assistant to the president for domestic policy, and where I coordinated federal government policy on welfare programs, including the negotiation and implementation of the welfare provisions in the One Big Beautiful Bill Act, OB3. I'm sure every viewpoint on OB3 is represented in that committee room. I'm sure some people love it. I'm sure some people hate it. I'm sure the same is true of the president. But it is the law, like it or not. It is the law now, and I urge you all to support this bill because it's a good way to take that first step to make sure that Minnesota is implementing it in a way that makes sense. And it's been mentioned already here today that Minnesota will be on the hook for a certain percentage of federal funds that when the error rate, that improper payment rate, goes above 3%. And so it's pretty important in terms of the state's general fund and other funding priorities, from law enforcement to schools to roads. That money's got to come from somewhere if the error rate is not kept under 3%. So I won't outline what's in the bill. Obviously, that's been done a few times, but several of the measures here which conform to OB3 should help keep and bring that improper payment rate down in Minnesota's Medicaid program. The redeterminations for able-bodied
30
adults.
30-second warning.
The redeterminations for the expansion population every 6 months instead of every 12. The trimming down of retroactive eligibility and bringing Minnesota's law into compliance with federal law in terms of the categories of non-citizens that are eligible, and the quarterly review of the death master file, all things that should help on that front. I'm sure you all are familiar with the audits that have found millions of dollars in Minnesota going to managed care organizations even after beneficiaries' deaths. All of this will help with that effort. I'm sure I don't need to tell any of you in the room either how much of a microscope that Minnesota is under when it comes to welfare, waste, and fraud. And, you know,
and we have to, your 2 minutes is up. So
thank you, sir.
I know, sir. Thank you. We now go to Paul Vetta. And then after that will be Angela Youngberg, I should say. Go ahead.
Hello.
State your name and 2 minutes.
Thank you, Chair. Chair Backer, members of the committee, I am Paul Verrett. I'm the executive director of MAXA and the human services policy analyst for the Association of Minnesota Counties. And I'm here with Angela Youngberg, a consultant for the Association of Minnesota Counties. We're here to tell you quickly about the county impact on HR1. The other way around, the HR1's impact on counties. And the workload is going to increase for counties. Our costs are going to go up, and this is happening during a period of working through antiquated tech infrastructure, which is inefficient and error-prone, and also at a time, as I'm sure you're all aware, we cannot raise our property tax levies anymore. So we have a lot of challenges, and Angie Youngberg is going to go ahead and give you more detail about that.
Go ahead. State your name and share us your thoughts.
Great. Thank you. Thank you, Chair. And members of the committee, my name is Angela Youngberg. I am with the Association of Minnesota Counties. I am a consultant. Previous to this, I've worked in county government for well over 20 years. I just want to thank Representative Nadeau for this really important bill. It is essential that we conform to HR 1, and what we want to do as counties is make sure that we're successful with that. We've been working very closely with the state on this and on what this looks like, and it is a developing process as we have yet to receive final guidance on some pieces, and so it is a work in progress. Again, our goal is successful implementation, and we know that people and health systems will heavily rely on us to get this right. We ask that you consider the impacts of these changes, which include local costs and people having loss of coverage or a rise in uncompensated care. Counties are the local administration of the benefit, and so that means that we also assume 50% of the cost of administering the benefit. And so as things change and how we do our work at the local level, those costs will change as well. Based on everything that we've looked at, those costs will increase substantially. Please also note that as you're looking at this, there will be fiscal notes attached, but it does not reflect the local impact on property taxes. It's really important that as we go ahead with this, that we look for any areas of automation that we can, because when we have to comply with this and it is reliant upon manual workarounds for an aging technology system, workarounds equal errors, which we've talked about, payment errors, but it also increases costs for counties. There are a couple of things that we're paying close attention to in terms of what this will cost counties. The three main things are the non-citizen conforming language. We anticipate that to be a one-time cost because that will happen all at one time, and it will result in substantial overtime for counties, or delays in other areas is what it would actually result in. The other is changing from 12-month renewals to 6-month renewals. That doubles the work for the Medicaid expansion population, and we're highly dependent on the auto-renew rate. When we look at the calculations about what that will cost counties to just do that part of HR 1, we're looking at an estimated $6 to $10 million per year, and that will be ongoing. That's not a one-time cost. And last is community engagement.
30-second warning.
And we know that that will be an ongoing cost. The latest that we have found was in 2018, there was a study done by MMB and a memo issued that implementing work requirements at that time under those regulations was going to cost approximately $160 million per year to do. We don't know what that local cost will be. It will really depend on how much of that can be automated, and we are highly dependent on that being the case. The last thing I want to draw your attention to is periodic data matching. That is also in this bill, but it is not part of HR 1. And that is something that counties receive a $2.2 million allocation. And that would really double the work. So the language in the bill doubles the work to counties. And so we would really
I need
look
you
at what
to wrap it up, please.
Is. Thank you for your time today.
Okay, thank you. Is there anyone in the audience who wished to testify on House File 3439? Okay, seeing none, first person on the list is Chair Liebling. You have the floor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And first of all, I would like to object publicly to this bill being rushed through and to any limitation on debate. This is a very important bill. It needs full consideration. And I don't know if we're going to run out of time or not, but if I was the last person and wasn't allowed to speak, I would be very upset. So I just want to put that up front. So thank you for calling on me. I was here when we passed the Affordable Care Act through this legislature, and I remember Republicans, and I think most of you weren't even here, but it didn't matter that it was the law. Republicans were not going to comply with it, and indeed have spent all the time in between complaining about it, trying to undermine it, and never respected the fact that it was the law. And of course, the Affordable Care Act, the point was to cover Americans with insurance and to help people access care. Now we have this ugly bill coming from Congress, which absolutely is not about covering anybody or helping anybody access care. It's about cutting funding and giving it to billionaires, and we have seen that. And so to hear it's the law, we have to comply with it, I think that's, if it wasn't so sad, it would be laughable. Because this administration, Donald Trump doesn't care. He doesn't give a rip about the law. We have seen this over and over. He doesn't give a rip about the Constitution. His administration is the most lawless administration we have ever seen. And so to say that he will do X or Y if we don't follow the law, he's doing it already, and he's going to do it. So whether we should comply, comply, because Donald Trump and his administration, they will do bad things to us. We already know that he would love to and is trying to do whatever he can to Minnesota. That is
members,
very, very clear.
I would ask questions for the author. I like to keep the debate because we do have limited time. We will be taking a vote at 2:10, like it or not. Please keep the discussion questions to the author, please.
Well, Mr.
So other
Chair,
members, I'm not done. So other members can speak, Chair. Okay, go ahead. You have
the floor. Well, Mr. Chair, you did interrupt me. And this, we have never had a rule that we can't make statements that it's got to be a question. That would be a brand new one here. So I just do want to say that when you look at the language of this bill and you see, for example, the part where we're denying care to people, you know, redefining what it means to be a qualified non-citizen, denying care to refugees who are here lawfully, denying care to people who are here with asylum, denying care to people who have been granted withholding of deportation, et cetera, et cetera. I would just remind the committee that when you deny care to people, it does not stop them from getting sick. They still get sick. They still need care. And their illnesses cost people money, whether it's themselves, their family, their employer, or other parts of society. So I think this is, I'm sorry, this is not, certainly not about you, Representative Nadeau. I know you're trying to do something you think needs to happen here. I am absolutely opposed to this. I am going to be a no vote, and I again object to it being rushed through. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. We have Representative Hewitt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Vice Chair Nadeau. It is similar to Chair Liebling's to say that you're definitely threading a needle here. And I understand that, and I guess I'm going to be more pointed towards local, right? My concern when I heard HR 1 come out was, what's this going to do to rural health? What's this going to do to other safety nets? You know it because it's in your county, Hennepin County Medical Center. That is an uphill climb to where we need to go with that. Have you talked with them or had any fiscal analysis on Hennepin County and how this will impact any legislation we have to do? Because if we put this through and we, let's say hypothetically, we approve the ballpark tax, I think we could be back here in an emergency session because that hospital, as you know, it's in your area, is important to the whole state. It's not just a regular hospital. It is the safety net to the whole state. Have you had any discussions with them and to talk to them about what the impact will be with this bill? Thank you, Chair.
Vice Chair Nadeau.
And thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Hewitt. I have. And as you know, Minnesota HCMC's MA population is almost 80%. And so any impacts that that are occurring by this body or a federal body, that impact that are going to, they're going to impact our uncompensated care. Hennepin County taxpayers currently contribute $38 million in uncompensated care to HCMC. 40% of the patients that come to HCMC come from counties outside of Hennepin. Hennepin is a bit of a, we do have bills coming forward that address Hennepin. I'm trying to focus this bill, again, on trying to do what we can to minimize that negative impact as much as possible. I am trying to thread a needle to a point, trying to give guidance to CMS saying this is where Minnesota would like to go. So yes, Hennepin County, along with every other hospital, will be impacted by this bill and by what's happening at the federal level.
Representative Hewitt, follow up.
Thank you, Chair Backer, and thank you, Representative Vice Chair Nadeau, for that answer. I'm glad to hear that you talked to Hennepin County. Again, my colleagues across the aisle are more into those rural places that are going to also suffer from this because of the uncompensated care, and you hit on it. We're going to have a larger pool of uncompensated care. And remember, the state doesn't pay for uncompensated care. We leave it on the counties or we leave it on the hospitals themselves to figure out a way what service are they going to cut next. And so this is, and again, I'm not picking on you. I know this is something that is important to you, but we really, really got to put that into any kind of thought we have in the future. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Vice Chair Ryer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Vice Chair Nadeau. I have a couple things. The first one is I'm concerned about the counties. I'm concerned about the cost. And I have been on the team for enough large data transition projects to know the risk that we're facing in rushing through something like this. So my first question is, and it might be for Ms. Costanza, is that you mentioned there's a $200 million fund for grants. There's a 90% match for systems upgrades, system development. Is that 90% until we get to $200 million, or are those two separate things?
Go ahead. Yep, go ahead.
I'm handing that one off, Mr. Chair.
I see that. You can pass that. It's an option play. Go ahead.
Okay, excellent. Those are two, thank you, Chair, and thank you for the question. Those are two separate pools. So the 90% federal match applies to upgrades to Medicaid information systems, including the state's eligibility information system. That may not necessarily apply to upgrades to non-Medicaid information systems, but the data connections between them, specifically the design, development, installation, and the other activity are covered by that. The $200 million of grants are separate. Thank you.
Okay. Do you have a follow-up there, Vice
yes.
Chair Ryer?
Yes, thank you. And thank you for that. Is that guaranteed or discretionary at the will of the federal government? Because we've seen, and Mr. Centurino, I think is your name, mentioned how Minnesota is being treated very unfairly, my words, and targeted by the federal government. So would it be up to the federal government to decide which states get a share of that or get 90% match, or is that guaranteed?
Go ahead, please. Yes,
thank you, Chair, and thank you for the question. When it comes to the grants, the formula that CMS is required to use is based on the percentage of the state's overall percentage of the expansion population compared to the total national expansion population enrollment. So there's this dedicated formula in statute that CMS must follow for the grants. Separately, the 90% federal match is subject to an approval process by CMS. So it is within CMS discretion to approve or disapprove whether or not it meets that qualifying criteria. So far, I don't have any other experiences of other states to compare to or heard anything about other state experiences with that process thus far.
Okay. Last thing, Mr. Chair.
Go ahead.
I'm disappointed in the process. We discussed this in advance, and my point was that for us all collectively, both caucuses, to be able to hear each other and discuss this very, very important bill, pieces of legislation and policy. It's inappropriate to rush through. It's disrespectful. And I also just wanted to strongly object to that on the record.
Okay, thank you. Thank you. Before we go to Representative Mahahoon, I have a question for Ms. Carquist. I understand if people, they can shift, they won't, under this program, Minnesotans would not be losing care because they can shift onto Minnesota Care since we're a BHP. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair and members, I think there is probably some capacity to switch to either Minnesota Care or coverage through MnSHR, but I don't know the specifics of that, and I'd have to get back to you on that.
If you could, I would appreciate that. Thank you. Representative Mahmoud.
Thank you, Chair. I'm also very disappointed to keep hearing that this has to be done because it is the law, when we know we as a state are not ready, our infrastructure is not ready, and the federal hub is not ready for these verifications and the surge that they'll see in these verification requests. So that will put so much burden on all counties having to complete manual enrollment. I just wanted to know, have you talked to CMS, or if our guest here has talked with CMS, will we be ready next year, what that will look like, and how will we prepare our counties for these manual verifications and prevent people from delayed care and not getting the coverage that they need while those verifications are in process? Because I've seen what happens when we have an increase in manual verifications. You know, people go months without getting the coverage that they need. Thank you.
Representative Doe, who wants to do that one?
I'll address the issue, and then Ms. Costanza can address the CMS component. So yes, it's going to be challenging, but our eligibility determinations in Minnesota have been always challenging. They're doubling, and so it's going to have a huge impact on our counties. But I also want to talk about the opportunities that we have. I mean, we have this archaic system that does eligibility determinations that we haven't changed since 19 whenever. We have Maxis and SSIS that ultimately require massive amounts of effort by individuals, and there's absolutely no reason why we shouldn't be looking at this and saying, you know what, there's grants out there for us to be able to create a system that provides healthcare eligibility in a format that works for everyone, that saves money, not costs money, but saves money. I mean, think about FAFSA. It's an eligibility, determination system for, financial aid for college students. MNsure is a platform to determine healthcare eligibility. So, yes, in the short term, we have a huge problem. Second, these go into effect before we come back into session. So I'm just trying to move us there. And third, I was going to save this for my last comments, but just because we have a lack of federal, guidelines or a lack of information coming from CMS doesn't mean that we should do the same to our agencies and our counties and not provide guidance from the legislature. Right. So that's what I'm trying to do, and I get it. We're moving too fast. There was a lot of things in my first session that moved too fast, and I don't like it. I want there to be lots of conversation about this. I want oral amendments. We're going to pass or fail this bill. It'll be laid over. I'm going to continue to work on this bill because the impacts are too great for us not to.
Okay, follow-up, Representative Mahmoud?
Oh, yes, for our guests.
Oh, go ahead. Oh, I'm sorry. You wanted to share something. Go ahead, ma'am. Yes.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, member. So I can't speak to Minnesota's readiness in specifically, and we haven't communicated directly with CMS. One thing that I will flag is within the bill, within OB3, there is an option for states to request an extension for implementation. CMS so far has communicated that they are unlikely to grant those extension requests from any state. That could evolve as we move throughout the year, and as this is a challenge for all states that are implementing this. It's not just Minnesota. So if states consistently may need that extension, we could see CMS's position on those extensions changing. But as of right now, we anticipate that CMS is unlikely to grant extensions beyond the implementation deadline of January 1st, 2027.
Thank you. Follow-up? Okay, good. We have Representative Lee.
Thank you, Chair. Let me also, along some of the comments that Representative Liebling made earlier, remind everyone that this administration made these cuts to our health care, affecting some of the most vulnerable folks in Minnesota, so that way they could have the funds to give to DHS, making ICE and Border Patrol and those forces, probably the most well-funded paramilitary forces in the world. And what have they been doing? They've been harassing and terrorizing all across America, but especially here in the last few months in Minnesota. So that circles back to this bill that we're looking at right now. I appreciate Representative Nadeau's work, but there's a lot more to go because here, line 7-3, you're crossing out sections that would be covering veterans of the United States Armed Forces with an honorable discharge. And then also, right after that, persons on active duty in the United States Armed Forces, other than for training their spouses and unmarried minor dependent children. So, I mean, there's just a lot of little details that we still need to continue to work out. So I appreciate what you just said, Rep. Nadeau, in terms of needing to work on this some more, because it is obvious to me that we need to do that. So I appreciate that. You're willing to do that, and so, yeah, let's do that. And in good faith, because there are a lot of folks that are expressing a lot of concerns, especially a lot of organizations. There's letters pertaining to the next bill that we're going to hear today. So let's all come together, and let's make this as effective as possible so we don't lose as much money as we can. And make sure that as many Minnesotans, vulnerable Minnesotans, are taken care of as much as possible. Thank you, Chair.
Okay. Chair Bierman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, I want to request a roll call.
Please do.
Yep.
And first, again, I want to extend my appreciation to NCSL for being here and to others who have helped shed light on how other states are reacting to this bill, but voting it out today is completely premature. I want to thank Representative Nadeau for taking the bull by the horns and starting this work, but we are only starting it. And I think it's important, it's very important that we're all fully informed on the hard choices in front of us before we decide on our response to H.R. 1. You may not have noticed, but Minnesota is not an automatic comply state. The reality is that President Trump eliminated coverage for millions of Americans and many thousands of Minnesotans, perhaps as many as a quarter million of us. That bill made sweeping changes to our healthcare system, and it left it to the states to pick up the pieces. My perspective is that this legislature must do everything in our power to minimize the damage to our state, to providers, and to the people who depend on Medicaid for the care they need to survive. I have no interest whatsoever in going beyond the draconian cuts that have already been made. If the House GOP position is that we must eliminate even more Minnesotans' coverage as some sort of way to be obedient to Trump, then we have a serious challenge in front of us. It's my hope that we can unify around the principle of keeping as many people insured as we can. We must protect people's access to preventative care and out of the emergency room. When they go there, we all pay for that. And we need to take action to defend healthcare providers from the most severe and consequential cuts to healthcare any of us have ever seen in our lifetime. This legislature must react to H.R. 1. But I would encourage members to read the testimony in our packets and realize that this bill as written is not the correct approach. It does not minimize the harms of H.R. 1 and it goes beyond the requirements set by Congress. For that reason, I'll be voting no today. Understanding that there are many more conversations that we need to have around this issue before it leaves this committee. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, thank you. Before I go to Representative Doe, what I'm going to make a comment. For us not, you know, I heard earlier we talked about the Affordable Care Act. I sat through all that and so forth in the 2014, 2015. Was I happy? No. I supported the understanding that we as a body, when the parent, the federal government, gives you money, they get to tell the guardrails. And the challenge we have, I think it's a huge irresponsibility if we do not conform with this. Are we happy 100%? Of course not. This is one of those issues that, like Vice Chair Nadeau says, that we're not all going to be happy, okay, and so forth. But the parent set the guidelines. And if we don't conform with it, it greatly will hurt our healthcare system even more, to the tune of anywhere from $3-3.5 billion and more. So, yes, I will be a yes vote. And with that, I'm going to leave the final comment to Vice Chair Nadeau.
And thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, members. And I apologize for the speediness that we feel that we need to move this, to keep this moving. I will reiterate that we do want to provide legislative guidance to counties, to the agencies. We have a lot of oversight and a lot of things to do here. And I do want to specifically mention Representative Bierman's comments. And I assure you that this bill does not go one inch past decreasing eligibility beyond what HR 1 requires. And if it does, correct me, point it out, and I will fix it. But that was, when Annie and I drafted that, it was religious to that compliance issue. Thank you, members.
Okay, with a roll call vote being called, go ahead.
Chair Backer?
Aye.
Chair Bierman?
No.
Vice Chair Nadeau?
Aye.
Vice Chair Ryer?
Ryer, no.
Representative Bonner?
No, and with strong objection to the process.
Representative Carroll?
No.
Representative DePell?
Aye.
Representative Elkins?
No.
Representative Franson?
Sorry, yes, and this is the process is moving along just like when the Democrats were in control.
Representative Gilman?
Yes.
Representative Hewitt?
No.
Representative Keeler?
No.
Representative Knitson?
Yes.
Representative Lee?
No.
Representative Liebling?
No.
Representative Mahmoud?
No.
Representative Perryman?
Yes.
Representative Purcell?
Purcell, no.
Representative Rapinski?
Yes.
Representative Schumacher?
Aye.
Representative Van Binsberg?
Yes.
Representative Zelenstikar?
Aye.
The motion fails. Tie 11-11. Okay. And we're going to lay it over. Yeah, it fails. So it's just on the table. Yeah, we can take it up later if we need to. So, but that motion failed because it was 11-11 tie. Okay. With that, we had so much fun with that bill. We get a second bill from you, Representative Nadeau. Man, you are full of fun. With that, the second bill we have for consideration is House File 3763. Representative Nadeau, would you like to move that House File 3763 to get it before the committee? Yes.
Yes, I would like to move my bill, Mr. Chair.
Okay, Representative Nadeau moves the House File 3763 to be recommended and referred to the Committee of Judicial Finance and Civil Law. To your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, members. If you liked that bill, this one should really make you happy. I'm teasing. This one was drafted in the general direction, and honestly, with less guidance than we had on the other bill. But once again, this is the community engagement, the work requirements that are a requirement of HR 1. I'm not going to go over again the penalties that we could incur by not complying. We can have that discussion after if you'd like. But when we did this bill, we had there are some options as far as consequential number of months that one has to work, what that work looks like. There's a number of exemptions that we've spent time on in this bill. And once again, I'm going to, before I go into the bill like I did the last time, I do want to mention something that Representative Bierman said at kind of one of the questions to Ms. Costanza, is the challenges that we have in verification for work. That is going to be an ongoing issue that we really need to put our heads together and work on. So starting on the first page, this is a new section of law. Its community engagement requirements, once again, it's primarily focused on the expansion population. Starting on line 1.15, 1.16, in here we have an option of 1 to 3 months of work requirements. I can think where half of the population would want that to be 1 month. I could think that half the population would want that to be 3 months. And so we chose 2 consecutive months, and then for that for the expansion population, and then for the 2 non-consecutive months for the non-expansion population. Moving over into on page 2, this is where we get into the requirements, and these are right from HR1. There's not anything we added here. There's not anything we subtracted. We basically addressed the U.S. code that we have to apply by. Then you get into the middle of the page, starting at 2.16. You get into the exceptions, and so it's foster care at age 18, and it goes down. Parent guardians of caretakers, veterans with disability, a total disability rating, receiving if you're on MFIP, a member of the household who receives SNAP benefits, someone in a SUD treatment or alcohol treatment rehabilitation program, an inmate, which is a change, an inmate of a public institution, individual who's medically frail. This is where we have some space in here how to define this. And if you look in there, starting really at 3.6 kind of to 3.9, you'll see where I came down. Once again, this is something we should talk about, discuss. Agencies will hopefully have some input on this as well. And then we get into the short-term hardship exemptions, which Ms. Costanza, talked about quite a bit during her presentations, where we have listed, starting at 3.23, we start inpatient hospital services, nursing facilities, inpatient psychiatric, we go down, through the list of those short-term hardships exemptions. And then, of course, the compliance, where we're required to do it every 6 months, we applied that. There is no, the states can choose to verify more than that. I would love it if we developed a system that is constant and ongoing, kind of like we do with NET study, with our background studies that are a constant ongoing thing. There's nothing to prohibit us from that. Moving on to 4.81, this is where it provides the commissioner and DHS a little bit more authority to comply on future guidance. We tried to insert that language where we thought it was important. And that's also where periodic data matching is. We could increase that. And right now we could increase the frequency depending on the cost. I'm not sure of how that would help us with error rates, but I think that's something that we need to continue to think about as we're either going to comply or not comply with this. But it's an opportunity for us. Outreach to applicable individuals starting on 5.16. Here, we put January 1, 2027, and this is kind of the, maybe this date needs to be earlier than that. And then we get to lines 6.10. This is why we're going to send this bill to judiciary. This is basically, from this point on, it's for judiciary. It's adding the 256B statutes to the data practices. Adding those new community engagement requirements along with wage reporting under 268 that allows those wage data to be shared without consent of the subject person. And I think that is the end of the bill, Mr. Chair. And I think there's some testifiers.
Yes, we do. We have 4 testifiers. So, again, 2 minutes. You'll give a 30-second warning when your 2 minutes is up. And we have, again, on Zoom from with Scott Santorio, Mr. Italian. And speak up loud. Remember, you were a little soft there, Mr. Italian.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Scott Centurino, representing FGA Action, former Special Assistant to the President for Domestic Policy. Again, I encourage each member of the committee to support this bill. It does the important work of implementing the largest pro-work welfare reform in American history, to put it simply. I just want to point out one nuance with my time with you all. You may hear that it's an average of 20 hours per week is the work requirement, and that's true. Working, training, or volunteering for 20 hours per week is one of the paths to comply for those able-bodied adults. But another path that doesn't get talked about as much is simply earning the equivalent of that number of hours at minimum wage. And how many jobs even pay $7.25 an hour these days? What that means in real terms is that if a person earns $580 a month, they are compliant with the work requirement, period, full stop, no matter how many hours. And so in the real world, that means a couple of shifts a week at $17 an hour. And that's obviously much more common than the minimum wage. So under this bill, someone can get 6 months of free Medicaid in Minnesota if they earn less than $1,200 over 6 months. So if anybody's concerned about the burden of a work requirement, just keep that in mind, but that is a major path to compliance here. And I think that's the least that this body can ask able-bodied adults who are receiving taxpayer-funded coverage, which is paid for by hardworking Minnesotans, working a lot more than two shifts a week for a couple months a year. So I urge you all to support this bill as a signal that you all will comply and lift as many Minnesotans out of dependency as possible. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Dana Bacon, and then after Damon is Thomas Elnis. Please state your name, and again, 2 minutes, you'll be given a 30-second warning.
Hi, Chair Backer and members. I'm Dana Bacon. I'm Senior Director of State Government Affairs for Blood Cancer United, which used to be the Leukemia and Lymphoma Society. I'm here in opposition today to this bill for the same reasons I came to the House HHS Committee 8 years ago this month to testify in opposition to another Medicaid work requirement bill. At that hearing, 27 witnesses came forward to speak against the unintended consequences of a work reporting requirement. We talked about paperwork mishaps, reporting burdens on enrollees, costs to local units of government, and more. The committee managed to move the bill, but that bill did not proceed to a floor vote and died there. Now, we all know federal laws changed since, and the provisions of H.R. 1 require Minnesota to implement the policies that we're talking about today. However, the harms of these policies haven't changed, and I discourage you from putting this policy into state statute. According to the nonpartisan KFF, 11 out of every 12 Medicaid expansion enrollees are working, providing home care, going to school, or are too sick to do any of the above items. Risking the coverage of these Medicaid expansion enrollees to teach a lesson to the 1 in 12 enrollees who aren't already doing one of these things is reckless. It's harmful to patients, to families, to hospital systems, and to communities. Now, as we've already said, this is federal law. We're going to be doing this.
30-second warning.
But putting this into our statutes is harmful, and I'd encourage you to direct your energies toward the state plan amendment process, which Minnesota will be using to comply with this law. Thank you.
Thank you. Appreciate that. Go ahead, Thomas Elnis. State your name, and then we have Emily Might after you. Go ahead. State your name in 2 minutes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Thomas Elnis. I serve as the State Advocacy Director with AARP Minnesota. Today happens to be our lobby day, so we have some folks in the room as well in their red vests. I want to thank Representative Nadeau. He and I had a good conversation earlier this week about making sure that we are accurately and fairly defining caregivers in this law. So AARP, I would respectfully encourage you to consider our letter that we submitted that each of you have. There's a definition of a caregiver in there that we believe to be in compliance with the federal law and would ask you to consider adopting as well. Like other testifiers, we would also encourage using 1 month instead of two for the look back period to ensure that fewer people are losing access to coverage. I am happy to stand by for questions or provide follow-up assistance. AARP really wants to be a resource, not just in Minnesota, but across the country in helping states to adopt language that makes sense. So I would thank you for that and stand by for questions. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. And state your name, 2 minutes, 30-second warning, go for it.
Good afternoon, Chair Backer and members of the committee. My name's Emily Myatt, and I'm the Regional Government Relations Director for the American Cancer Society Cancer Action Network. Not to be outdone by AARP, it is also our day on the Hill, and folks are in this room wearing blue shirts today. As an organization, we are broadly opposed to work requirements and community engagement requirements, but acknowledge Minnesota must adopt them. So I want to discuss two specific provisions in the bill we'd like to see amended or removed, and I want to thank Representative Nadeau for the conversation earlier this week. Section 1, Subdivision 1, requires that two-month look-back period for applications and renewals to determine compliance for work requirements. We would request that language be amended to the one-month look-back period, and then also for that renewal process, 1 month in any of the previous 6 months. And this will help minimize coverage loss, especially for those going through cancer treatment. Section 1, Subdivision 2, 9B, requires the commissioner to develop forms that healthcare providers must complete in order for an individual to apply for an exemption. Cancer patients and survivors are already juggling navigating complex treatments and appointments. This type of paperwork is an additional burden for cancer patients and their caregivers. We would request this language be removed and patients are allowed to self-attest, which is allowed under HR 1. Again, happy to continue these conversations and be a resource so that we can avoid unintended consequences that will hurt Minnesota.
30-second warning.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you so much. Is there anybody in the audience that would wish to testify on House File 3763? Okay, seeing none. We open up to questions. We will be taking a vote at quarter two. Questions for the author? Co-Chair Bierman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you. Representative Nadeau, we briefly spoke about the definition of medical frailty earlier. I didn't know if DHS is in the room and might be able to comment on that definition and compared to the federal.
No.
Do we have?
Director? Here, but
don't know.
Don't know yet. So we
got to phone a different friend.
Well, I think it's either that or we're potentially just waiting on the federal rules.
Okay. Yep.
So it could be that one, and it was mentioned earlier. The caregiver definition as well. So. Those are just some things that we'll want to look into as this bill gets more work. Thank you.
Any comments there, Vice Chair Nadeau?
Thank you, Mr. Bierman, or Representative Bierman.
Okay, there you go. We have Representative Lee. Then.
Thank you, Chair. As is stated, and I think everybody agrees, Rep. Nadeau, it's very challenging, these work requirements and the implementation. I agree with all the letters and support for a one-month period. Let's do our best to try to minimize the impact as much as possible. And so I think if that is the minimum for the time period, then I think let's go with that. There's a lot of work to be done. So forgive me if I'm new, Chair, but like. I'm not even sure, like, do we need to take the vote today?
We will be taking a vote today, yes, because the motion was initially that it would move to judicial and civil law. So the motion was referred to the Committee on Judicial Finance and Civil Law there, Representative Lee.
Okay.
And also at the same time, I don't know if Representative Nadeau said, mentioned this initially, but I remember during our discussion beforehand, if someone wanted to make an oral amendment, you would have been you're open to that.
Absolutely.
That's right. Thank you.
Okay, so then I move for a roll call.
Okay. When we go for, but the Representative Lee has requested roll call. Okay, Representative Lee, did you have any further discussion with the author of the bill?
I'm done, thank you.
Okay, thank you. We have Representative Bonner has the floor.
Has anyone consulted with Minute or with the agencies about the eligibility requirements and specifically the modernization or technology systems that are, would be required to do that?
Go ahead, Vice Chair Nadeau.
No.
Okay, Representative Bonner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I will just say from the last bill and to this bill, in the last, during the pandemic, we had to do re-enrollment of eligibility through a paper process, a manual process, because we did not have an electronic process. In addition, the last bill, and I suspect this bill as well, has a number of requirements which require data sharing. And there was some language in this bill that talks a little bit about data sharing, but I just want to be very clear that data sharing, and particularly in Minnesota, isn't as easy and cut and dry as it looks. Our data privacy laws are a little bit different than other states in some places and our practices. First of all, getting sharing agreements between agencies can be very complex. It can take months, sometimes years. In addition to that, if you were to get those agreements in place, then there's also enabling the technology and able to share that data and whether or not that can be done. I know there are some systems currently, including, I believe it's Maxis, that cannot currently receive data feeds on things like work requirements. So those things are already not in place. But one of the things that we heard from the first testifier, Ms. Costanza, is that there would be a heavy reliance on technology in order to make these pieces work. So let's just say hypothetically, we put aside the objections, just hypothetically, and we say, yes, we're going to do everything and more. But in order for this to actually work, we're going to need the technology to make it work, or it's going to fail, and we will not be able to comply. We will not be in compliance, and we will lose the money regardless of whether we put it in our statute or we don't. And not only that, we said there was potentially money available, including the 90% match or the $200 million, but the 90% match relies on an approval process, which is subject to the whim of the federal government, which means they could say, yes, Minnesota, we agree. This is a great idea. You should do it. Or if they just didn't feel like it this day, which we've seen from this administration on numerous occasions, they could just say, you know what? We don't feel like it. You're out of luck. And if that happens, not only do we not have the technology plan to get in place, we don't have the money to put it in place. And we put all that on top of driving people off their health care. We put that on top of increasing the burden of MA cuts on our hospitals and our clinics and our facilities. We are already on the verge of losing HCMC, which already is unsustainable to push that burden onto other cities and other hospitals across Minnesota, where they are already making tough decisions to cut care. In greater Minnesota, we are cutting prenatal and pregnancy care and delivery care for moms right now, before any cuts have taken place, before we've even considered the burden of uncompensated care in those facilities, before we've even contemplated the cuts in this bill. And we're sitting here talking about rushing this through without having any of the technology pieces in place. We have not talked to any of the stakeholders that would have a plan to put the technology in place. We have not discussed with any of those stakeholders what those timelines would look like to get them in place. And yet we are rushing through a bill like a runaway train without any idea whether we can even meet the requirements because we haven't talked to the people who we need to talk to. And this is all due respect, and I understand, Representative Noe, you are trying to do your best. And I respect that. I even respect some of the work that you've done in this bill to try and make it better. But this is not a thing that we can just rush through. This has massive impact on our entire state budget.
It has massive impacts on our technology infrastructure. It has massive impacts on Minnesota care if we shift people. And by the way, we still have to subsidize that care, which means our taxpayers still have to pay for it. What we are talking about is a massive shift from the federal government's responsibility to states. That's what we're talking about here. That has massive implications for our future, but it has massive implications for our people. And let us make no mistake, when we cut those people off that list and we cut them off from care, people will die. That is not a negotiable. That is not a pie in the sky thing. When we cut people off from care, people die. That is the way it works. And Mr. Chair, can you please ask the members to be quiet?
Please don't yell.
I think that it's just disrespectful. But
okay. Be quiet. I didn't hear anything on this one. So.
I will just say that I will wrap it up. But I think my underlying point here is that we are trying to put in place, rush through a plan, but quite frankly, it is a plan to fail. It is a plan without any execution of a plan in place. There's no timeline here. There's been no discussion about how we implement any of this or if it's even realistic. And just for the record, Minnesota is further ahead on some of our technology modernization planning and projects, which takes literally years, by the way, than most states. And if we can't do it in Minnesota, then I don't think there's a chance, and you know what, that some of the other states are going to make it happen. So if we're going to be serious about how we're going to accept this and how we're going to do this, we need to be having that conversation, how we're actually going to implement this thing. Because otherwise, all of this is nonsense. It's just one giant plan to fail. And I will just leave it there and move on.
Thank you. Representative Hewitt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I know you want to get on with the vote. Real simply, Vice Chair Nadeau, again, same thing could be said about this one. You are threading a needle here. And I respect you for giving it a try. I've been in those situations myself. Maybe I'm not that bright here, but I'm wondering, are the counties the monitors? I mean, the counties probably intake, and then they would be also the surveillers or the monitors of these people that they're supposed to be a work condition. Are they the ones that are going to be monitoring to make sure that they keep that, or who would do that?
Representative Nadeau.
Thank you, Representative Hewitt, the state.
Representative Hewitt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Doe. The state would do it. Are we appropriating money for the state to do it, or what are we? Where's this money coming from to monitor this?
Representative Doe.
Thank you, Representative Hewitt. Not yet. This is the first step. This is basically trying to give direction from the legislature about how we want to move into conformity with the work requirements that are placed on us by the federal government. So this is basically enabling legislation. It's talking about where the data is going to be shared. The implementation component that Representative Bonner talked about is the next phase.
Follow-up, Representative Hewitt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Vice Chair Nadeau. Just real quickly, I would like to find to get to common ground here, but in this situation, I think that to send this on to one of the other committees, I thought I saw where we're going to send it, but to do that without a fiscal note, especially because we're a financial committee, it's going to be hard to support this today. Like you said, it's work in progress, but I think I would feel much better seeing the fiscal note and see where we're going to pull the money from. So thank you for being patient with me. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Chair Bierman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to ask about that fiscal note. I think we're going to get it in a week or so, is what I'd understood. Is that correct, Representative Nadeau?
Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bierman, the fiscal notes have been requested, but we don't
I don't have a time frame or
no
a
time
promise.
Frame.
Or
okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, I just wanted to ask one more thing of Ms. Costanza up there and give you the last word. Appreciate your information and you sitting through the discussion here and hoping that you could give us any final words on anything that, if you have any final thoughts for us as far as anything we may have missed or advice, just want to give you the last word.
Ms. Costanza, I know you're having a lot of fun, so, but go ahead.
Not much to contribute in addition to the vibrant discussion that has already occurred. There are obviously choices that state legislatures have to make. You all have authority to set direction of your policy priorities, and this is one of those discussions.
Thank you.
That's all I have to say.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and just to confirm, we're having a roll call.
Yeah, there is a roll call, but we do have one more member. We have Representative Van Binsbergen. You have a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Nadeau, I got a question. The main target of this bill is it targets individuals who are physically able to work. Is that right?
Vice Chair Nadeau.
That is correct.
Go ahead.
So I guess I want to go on the record, and I want to thank the taxpayers of this state for their generosity. For far too long, our state government has taken advantage of the taxpayers of Minnesota. My constituents believe that people need to work, having a job before we just hand out free insurance. So I want to be on the record that I just want to thank the people of this state for paying the bill.
Okay. Representative Nadeau, you get final words. It's
thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, members, for the discussion. I appreciate the acknowledgement of the effort that we're trying to make here. I recognize that it's not perfect. I do, complying with what the federal government thinks they need us to do is difficult. And I do want to reiterate that one of the testifiers, the undersung exemption from work requirements under HR 1 is to make $580 a month. So along with the other things that we have to talk about, the frailty, the medical exemption, some of those other things, I do hope that as this moves forward, that we work together. I think it'll be a lot better if we can. I think that there's a lot of guidance that we need to have. But like I say, this is a first step. I trust the agencies to be able to implement the work that we do. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members.
With that, we have a roll call vote, and we will go to the roll call vote, members.
Chair Backer?
Aye.
Chair Bierman?
No.
Vice Chair Nadeau?
Aye.
Vice Chair Ryer?
No.
Representative Bonner?
No.
Representative Carroll?
No.
Representative DePell?
Aye.
Representative Elkins?
No.
Representative Franson? Representative Gilman?
Aye.
Representative Hewitt?
No.
Representative Keeler?
No.
Representative Knutson?
Yes.
Representative Lee?
No.
Representative Liebling?
No.
Representative Mahmoud?
No.
Representative Perryman?
Aye.
Representative Purcell?
Purcell, no.
Representative Rapinski?
Aye.
Representative Schumacher?
Aye.
Representative Van Binsbergen?
Aye.
Representative Zelenskar?
Aye.
Okay. The motion does not prevail due to 11-11 tie. So Folks, we are coming back here next Monday for more fun in the sun here in St. Paul. So thank you. Seeing no further business, the meeting is adjourned. Thank you, members.